It's not like you could walk down any street and see a blacksmith shop or a sword maker's forge, but those things do still exist. Now let's turn up the unlikeliness. Imagine walking down a street and finding the forge of a sword maker, a maker of fine Japanese swords, and it's nowhere near Japan. It's in Oregon, near Coquille to be exact. That's where father and son swordsmiths Michael Bell and Gabriel Bell do business as Dragonfly Forge, making fine Japanese swords. Michael Bell, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Gabriel, good to hear from you, too.
Thank you for having us. Glad to be here.
So, Michael, this starts with you. Was it a hobby first?
It was purely an accident, as a matter of fact. I'd never really planned on becoming a swordsmith until I met Mr. Nakajima Muneyoshi, in 1970. And I had been a musician and a guitar builder, so I had some skills with tools, but I completely fell in love with the Japanese sword, its art, its history, its sculptural qualities, its graphic qualities, not so much as a weapon even, but as an object of art and history.
Does it tell a story of sorts?
Often they do. The Japanese sword has not changed fundamentally in 1,000 years. And many of the old swords of that age still exist. They've been preserved very carefully. And they come with all sorts of legends and stories and, basically a mix of myth and history.
Is this the kind of thing that is passed down from generation to generation to generation?
Often it is, both the swords and the skills in making them. So in Japan, it's not uncommon to have multiple generations of smiths, all in the same lineage, often natural-born sons, but if they didn't have one, then they would adopt one. So some of the schools have gone on for, 20 and 30 generations.
Okay, I get that you're a craftsman because, working with your hands is working with your hands, but boy, the stark differences, I would think, between working the wood to make guitars and working the metal to make swords, there must have been a bit of a learning curve there.
Oh, a huge learning curve. I mean, with wood, you are generally cutting and removing, and with metalworking, you're shaping. It's more plastic, and often you are assembling a blade from many components. So it's rather more involved than most people expect. We run a school and have taught some very wonderful people from all around the world, and somewhere about 3 days into our class, I will ask them, how does this compare with your expectations? And often the response is, whew, I never knew so much went into making a sword. So,
Hey, Gabriel, let's hear from you. Were you always bound to follow your father into this business?
Well, actually, kind of the opposite. I grew up pretty unique childhood. My father owned a cutlery shop in San Francisco when I was born, but not long after that, we decided to move to Southern Oregon, rather my parents did, and to pursue sword making really full time and set up an independent forge. And to do that meant, living in the country with, at first, no indoor bathroom and no grid electricity till I was about 9 or 10. So I certainly spent a lot of time in the shop, but I also saw a lot of the struggles that went along with pursuing, your passion as an artist. So it was kind of not what I wanted to do as a kid, actually.
You wanted to get away from it all, get to the bright lights in the big city?
Yeah, I didn't have a steady-paying job as, a more professional career.
So, Michael, you went really rustic there, it sounds like, in the early years of this trade.
It was a small price to pay. We built upon it incrementally. I remember somebody asking my wife, saying, well, wasn't that a hardship? And she thought for a moment and says, well, it was definitely an inconvenience, but I wouldn't call it a hardship. And, of course, now we're computerized. We have power to run a full shop. And, we just had to hang tough for a few years. And what do they say in the I Ching? Perseverance furthers, right?
Right. So how did you train, Michael? How did you get the skills necessary to be able to make these swords?
Well, as I mentioned, I, for whatever reason, was introduced to a Japanese master in 1970. And, I just sort of took it from there. Gradually, I found myself spending more and more time at his place, and then I was sleeping on his floor and eating miso soup every morning for breakfast, and 5 years went by rather quickly, but he was the perfect teacher in that he had mastered all of the various arts that are normally done by specialists. And for him, that was an economic necessity. He forged swords during the war, but after the war, there was no work for that, so he did what he had to do, but he went into polishing and restoration and took care of old swords. And so he'd learned all of those arts. And when I started, there were no specialists. I had to be able to do everything from forging the sword to making the scabbard to all of the parts, usually. And, that's what we do to this day.
Michael Bell and Gabriel Bell do business as Dragonfly Forge, making fine Japanese swords near Coquille. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about their craft. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Gabriel, how did you find your way back to the fold? I mean, it sounds like you've been around the sword since very early in your life.
Well, certainly, and as a teenager, I forged, my first knife and then Japanese swords pretty soon after. But when I headed to college, I was going to be a computer science and math major, and I just found myself more and more in front of a computer and realizing, what really made me happy was working with my hands and really creating something so directly. And so that led me back home, and, some of the skills and computer knowledge I learned I thought would be a huge asset to the company. So upon my graduation, we formed a partnership and have been moving forward ever since.
So how is the market for Japanese swords? I'm just curious to know how broad a collection of people come seeking out what you do and from where.
Oh, my. Well, we have clients from all over the world. Certainly a number of our swords reside in Europe. That's been popular all over North America and Canada. It's partly the website that Gabe has created that, gives us the exposure that... as you can imagine, it's a fairly small market, but there aren't a lot of people working in that, certainly in the West.
Gabe, are those your photographs on the website?
Well, my photographs and my programming and management of the site more than anything.
Mm-hmm. I ask because I wanted to know who to credit with the photo we cribbed for our website to be able to tell this story.
That or my mother. She did a lot of the administration and stuff before I came on board, and my father doing this for 40 years or more than that even now, he's built up a good reputation for himself. So, reputation is a big part in this business.
It seems that there are many different types of Japanese swords. Can you give us kind of a short list of the general type? I mean, I see katana, I see samurai. What else you got in there?
Well, a katana just is the longer sword that was the pair carried by the samurai. Not all Japanese swords were carried by samurai. Merchants carried shorter swords. Even in the old days, monks carried and fought one another between monasteries. The history is really quite varied. But the general form of it, the basic form, as I mentioned earlier, has not changed in 1,000 years. And one of the things that lends it to popularity is that for those who are martial artists, the schools exist for teaching that, multiple schools. Not only do we supply the artifacts to be used in that martial art, but the martial art itself is stable and growing and has many exponents around the world. So we're tied into that as well as the art world. So it's sort of have a foot in both realms.
When you're talking about a craft that has existed in pretty much the same form for 1,000 years, were there some mistakes early on, and people said, well, okay, here's why this doesn't quite work the way you did this, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think it was so much a mistake, but like any weapon system, there's going to be a counter system. And so as warfare changed, armor, for example, or tactics, the swords changed as well, but not to the degree that they did in Europe. So a trained eye can easily tell a sword that's 600 years old from one that's 300 years old. But to a novice, perhaps, they wouldn't be apparent.
Do you make anything other than the Japanese stuff? I mean, since you just mentioned Europe, I'm curious enough if you make European broadswords or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we both of us have done a number of unusual things for us. But yes, in fact, both Gabe and I are working on Chinese straight swords called a jian. Very much like a broadsword, but rather flexible. And they're heat treated differently, but the component forging is basically the same.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about, too, when you get to the metallurgy. I mean, we've learned a lot more about how metals respond to certain elements and heat and all that stuff. I mean, do you use modern techniques, or is it strictly traditional, as it would have been done hundreds of years ago?
Well, the answer actually is both. We do a very traditional line using a type of steel called tamahagane, which is literally means jewel blade metal. And this was made traditionally from sand iron, just the same black sand that gold miners will have, and then that is reduced, smelted into iron and steel, and then they would, you know, you've heard of how they fold the steel, and that it leaves patterns in the steel, which it does when it's polished, and they can be quite beautiful. The grain of wood or the ripple of a stream, all of this will show up in the metallurgy itself. But that wasn't what they were trying to achieve. What they were taking was a primitive type of smelting, and in order to distribute the carbon evenly throughout the steel, they had to fold it, because when you're starting, it would be higher and lower carbon contents, and they had to homogenize it to some extent. But having done that, they quickly learned that there was beauty in it as well, and so I think polishing, you know, really... the metallographic revelation of what's in the metal started very, very early. And indeed, if you're going to sell a blade, you have to have them, you know, where the buyer can look at them and actually see the integrity and the quality of it. So, we also do a modern wrinkle, and many of our blades are now forged, still traditionally hand-forged, but we start off with a length of logging cable, forge that into a bar and manipulate it in various ways. And the beauty of it is that it's tremendously tough. It also has that beautiful grain in it that will show with polish. And
so the grain is there from when it was a cable?
Exactly,
wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And with cables, the basic bundle of cables are laid to the right, a right-hand twist, but the components are a left-hand twist. So you get this bias of grain running through it, which makes them tremendously strong, virtually impossible to break without deliberately trying to do so. Hmm. And we can make them rather faster because we don't have to, you know, spend, you know, a week making steel and then folding the metal. We could be a little more direct.
Michael Bell and Gabriel Bell, father and son of the proprietors of Dragonfly Forge, making fine swords, Japanese swords primarily, off near Coquille. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. How important is the wood and the skill at making the sheaths and handles for the swords?
Okay, thanks for that, Mark. Michael?
Well, I would say that is where a lot of apprentices start. You know, you can gain skill with your hands and develop your eye. The choice of the wood is you want something that is not so hard that it will scratch a polished blade, so that rules out things like oak and the harder tropical woods. The Japanese use a type of magnolia traditionally, whereas we've gone to our lovely coastal alder, which is stable and it doesn't produce volatiles that will rust a sword, which is why we don't use cedar and pine and things like that. So the wood is important. The skills to are there. I mean, it's a profession in its own right, but it's a very good place for a craftsman to start if he wants to work on swords.
Gabriel, since you were around it growing up and then kind of walked away and but came back later on, I'm just curious to know how long it takes to get good at what you do.
Well, as an apprentice, I would say it takes at least 1 year, if not a little more, before you do much of anything productive for the organization. As far as the technology of the forging and stuff, I think, you know, there's one famous smith in Japan who said, anybody can learn the techniques and the technology in about 2 or 3 years. It's after that that the problems start. I think what he meant there is, you know, the aesthetic and the artistic elements that really make a blade just sing, that really takes a lot of time. That's what takes the most time to develop, for sure.
And how long does it take to make an individual sword?
Oh, that can vary considerably, but at least 6 months to, you know, forge and mount one.
Wow, that's a lot of time. So how much do these things cost?
Well, once again, that's a big variable, but a katana will start about $8,000 and go up to somewhere around $20,000.
Okay, so there's a fair amount of money invested in there. I understand that you were invited to make swords for the movie The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise and turned it down.
Well, the exchange there was that I would get credit, right? But they also wanted me to provide them $8,000-$10,000 sword and several of them for free. And I've been on movie sets. I know how they treat those things. I didn't expect to get them back intact. So if they wanted to buy them, I'd have happily sold them. But if they weren't going to buy them, I wasn't going to provide them for free. And that's the sort of the way it is.
Sounds like an easy decision. Talk about the school. You mentioned having a school out there. How long do people take that school?
Well, we've been running the school formally for about 8-9 years now. Before that, I was just getting requests from other smiths and curious people to give them some instruction, which I would do on a informal basis. And then I was also invited to do demonstrations and seminars around the country. And so Gabe and I, when he got out of college, we looked at one another, well, let's do this formally. We'll set up a curriculum and various classes.
All right. Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I wish we could do it justice on the radio, but you can certainly see pictures of the sword-making process and the finished swords at the website for Dragonfly Forge, which is linked from our website at jeffexchange.org. Michael Bell and Gabriel Bell, the proprietors. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.